Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Ben Fritz of The Wall Street Journal. He is an entertainment industry reporter over there. You got a couple of them. I was listening to one of your colleagues on The Town this week talking about another kind of angle, another facet of what we're going to be discussing here today. The reason I wanted to get you on the show was to talk about a piece that you had this week, a nice exclusive about A24, the indie studio A24, teaming up with Google on some AI stuff. This touches on a lot of different kind of things that are going on in the industry right now. Like I said, we'll get to those in a second. But what's the deal? So what's going on with A24 and Google?
Yeah, so they have made a pretty unusual partnership where A24 is going to work with DeepMind, which is the AI research unit of Google, to develop new AI tools. Basically, A24 is going to try to bring in the filmmakers that they work with to collaborate with DeepMind and see if they can come up with ways that AI can help with storyboarding, pre-visualization, visual effects, touch-ups, things nobody's thought of yet to make filmmaking better. But they're very hard line. Google's not going to get access to any of A24's data. They're not going to be like training a model on, you know, on Marty Supreme and Backrooms or whatever. And also as part of the deal, Google is investing $75 million into A24, which is obviously a pretty tiny amount of money for Google, but it's meaningful. This is the first time it's ever put money directly into a studio.
It's a lot of money for A24. I mean, not, you know, they've been raising money kind of continuously. I think they were valued at $3.5 billion a couple years back after an investment from Thrive. So they are, you know, they're always looking for stuff. This is kind of unrelated, but they are also making a $175 million Elden Ring adaptation, which suggests that they do need some capital here. But let's actually talk about what the tools are here. Because I think when people hear AI in filmmaking, they think generative AI. They think like, I put in, I want to see Spider-Man punch Superman in, you know, the plagiarism box, and then it shows up on their laptop. Yeah. But that's not what's going on here, right?
Correct. So when the tools are made entirely by people in the tech world, that's what they generally come up with, is type in what you want and it magically creates a movie. And often we've seen those models end up creating things that look suspiciously like things that have already been created by humans in Hollywood. And when the Chinese model Seedance first kind of hit the world several months ago, we really saw some pretty amazing examples of that. That's not what A24 wants to do, and that's not what most filmmakers want to do. Most filmmakers are, of course, horrified by this idea that you just type in a few words and get something that sort of resembles a movie, but it has no soul to it. So the idea here is, can we create tools that would be actually valuable to filmmakers to let them do things that they can't do now, to let their creative process like be more effective and more efficient? I mean, the analogy someone who I spoke to at DeepMind used was AlphaFold. Now, obviously, filmmaking is not curing cancer, but in the sense that they worked with doctors and medical researchers to try to develop tools that would actually enhance medical research, not take it over, right? And that's what they want to do now. And one point they made to me over and over, people at A24 and DeepMind, is they don't know exactly what these tools are going to be, but they actually want to start collaborating to figure out what they can be, because they know what they don't want it to be. They don't want it to be Seedance. They don't want it to be type in a prompt and get a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. You know, this is a thing I talk about on my various shows, the kind of evolving idea of what the term AI even really means in a lot of these conversations. Because, you know, is machine learning that helps speed up CGI AI? Does that count? Like, does it, you know, and there was another, you know, kind of little fight about this a couple of weeks ago when Martin Scorsese announced a partnership with an AI firm to do part of what it sounds like Google and A24 will be doing here, working on storyboards, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. Yes. That's a very obvious, like, that's something sitting right in front of us. Like, because storyboards, pre-visualization, that's not really the ultimate creative work. That's something that you do that helps you figure out what you want the creative work to be. And AI, and it can be rough. It doesn't have to look great, right? And it doesn't have to have soul to it because it's not meant for the world to see. So that's one of the most obvious examples of something that AI can do. But what else could it do that would really enhance creativity? I think what Way24 and Google are betting on is there's things nobody's thought of. Hopefully there's things they can do that really will help artists.
Yeah. I should have mentioned this at the start of the show. Ben wrote a book, came out 2018, called The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies, which, if it came out in 2018, you probably finished it right around 2017, which means it's been about 10 years now, which means the entire future of film has changed since then. Yes. But it's a really great overview of where things kind of stood in the 2010s, right before this big tech boom, but as streaming was starting to take off, before COVID, kind of shut everything down and everybody funneled into that. So I would recommend just reading it for some good background knowledge there. But I was just sitting here sketching out all of the ways the different major and mini major studios have been messing around with AI and tech more broadly. And I have trouble finding a studio that's not doing something right now. Mm-hmm. It's pretty wild.
Well, it's like yes and no. That's the weird thing. Like everybody has announced deals of some kind or tests or experiments, strategic partnerships. But yet I will say, when you talk to the filmmakers, when you talk to the production studios, how are you using AI in your processes? The answers are usually minimal at best. Just to give one telling example, I did a story in March about Pixar, and I went up there, I spoke to Pete Docter, the chief creative officer. I mean, that's like CGI animation seems like an obvious place where AI could be helpful and could make the process faster and or cheaper. And they're not using it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the studios are definitely making moves, but yet filmmakers working at a professional level are not using it very much yet. There is still like a lot of opportunity here that we may see in the future.
Well, and there's also, I think part of the reason that they are so emphatic about not using it, right, is that there is still a stigma attached to it. There is still people saying, hey, we don't want AI replacing workers. We don't want AI replacing the creative process, right? Like this is our special sauce is the people, I'm much more AI skeptical myself than a lot of my friends, a lot of my fellow travelers. So I get wary about this sort of thing. But it does kind of feel like on the edges, at least some of these, again, like storyboarding or previs or whatever, it does feel like there could at least be some use there that is not wholly, anathema to folks.
Yeah. It's not going to replace, that doesn't replace creators. I mean, I think there is like a very optimistic, positive future people could be seeing, which is where AI does replace a lot of the work on a film that's not the most creative. And there's a lot of stuff that you do in the film that's not like purely like somebody with a vision doing creative work. And if AI can make all that get done faster and cheaper, then it should let creative people make what they want at a much lower cost. And when things cost less, you get more stuff and you get more creative, risky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we could just see more films and TV shows getting made, and we could see stuff that's a lot riskier than when the big studios play it safe.
This is the James Cameron argument, right? He says, I'm going to, instead of taking 7 years to make an Avatar movie, I'll be able to make, two in 3 years, and that will speed things along.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is the optimistic case. And I think it's quite possible, but the transition to get there is obviously quite rough. And, you know, there's people, middle-aged people working in Hollywood for a while who their livelihood depends on the way things have been done. And also the processes they built up are all human processes from beginning to end. And disrupting those processes is very, it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, obviously we know this is true in all sorts of businesses whenever a new technology comes along.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's just run through some of the other companies here, because I do, one thing I wanted this to kind of serve as is, as I mentioned in the email, like a kind of like a talk to me like I'm stupid, okay, run through of the of where we are with some of these companies and their relationships to tech and AI, right? Because it is pretty, again, it's pretty expansive. So like, for instance, Netflix and their partnership with they bought mm-hmm. Ben Affleck's AI company. What was that? What did that deal look like? What was Netflix hoping to get out of that?
So that it's a very specific AI tool, which seem like it could be helpful. It's this tool where you the AI creates like a small model based on, just on that movie. So it's all, and it's for work and post production at the end. So you shoot a movie, and then you basically put all of that footage, all the scripts, all information you have on that movie, you put into a new bespoke AI model. And then if you need to touch up the movie, if you need to do some reshoots afterwards, sometimes it'll do it for you. Like, a lot of movies get made and then people realize, oh shoot, like this scene doesn't make sense. Like we need to have just Sonny saying this one line, right? Or if we could just get a different angle on this, that on these two people talking that we didn't get that day, you would flow so much better. And now if you realize that, if you want to do it, you have to spend a lot of money to get your cast and crew back together and mm-hmm. get into the same location. And that it's very logistically difficult, and it can cost easily millions of dollars. And this AI company Ben Affleck started promises to be able to do that digitally with generative AI. So you could kind of create a shot that you weren't able to get on set.
Understanding that you are not, you know, sitting there in front of the computer working on watching these things yeah. roll out, the way I have been kind of led to understand how this works is that it more or less can create the image you want, but using the footage kind of that has already been shot as yeah. as training, like to yes. so it's not pulling from. It's not like we're not recreating a shot from Superman, right? We are using this footage that we've got here, and we're just going to, you know, the computer will show the face, you know, in shot reverse shot instead of, yes. you know, coverage.
Yes, exactly right. That's exactly what it can do. So when they make the Rip 2, you can just use all the footage from the Rip 2 to get a different angle on Ben Affleck's face than they actually managed to get on set or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Then let's see. There was the Disney OpenAI deal that involved. So this is now defunct. My understanding is yes. Disney and OpenAI that has fallen through. But Disney basically said to OpenAI, like, okay, you can use our stuff. You can use our stuff to train Sora. Or is that wrong?
Not to train. Basically, they said. So remember, like, Sora launched last summer, like the consumer app, and it was immediately like a copyright violation fiasco. Mm-hmm. And then pretty quickly, OpenAI agreed under pressure, okay, we're going to put in restrictions so you cannot generate a video with Homer Simpson or Darth Vader or the Minions or whatever. Then a few months later, Disney announced a deal with OpenAI that said, okay, actually, you are going to be able to use some Disney characters. Only animated ones, or ones like Darth Vader with a mask, like not ones that are based on real human actors, because that introduces all sorts of union rule issues and payment issues. But obviously, Disney completely owns the image of Mickey Mouse and Homer Simpson and so on. So they were going to let you make videos with them. And then in exchange, Disney was going to be able to put some of those videos onto Disney Plus. They were going to, it was sort of vaguely determined, like work with OpenAI and some new tools, and Disney was going to get a $1 billion stake essentially in OpenAI. Mm-hmm. So that was the terms of the deal. And then in March, OpenAI, for completely unrelated reasons, decided to shut down Sora. Like, if the consumer app wasn't actually doing very well. And OpenAI, of course, has a very limited amount of compute and money to throw at problems. And it decided that, you know, video generation was not a priority compared to trying to compete with Anthropic for, you know, for corporate business and coding and that kind of thing. So they shut down Sora and they just called Disney and were like, actually, it's over. Like, this whole thing you were counting on to be the linchpin of your AI strategy, like, it doesn't matter to us. So we shut it down. So long. Good luck.
Yeah. And the sense I get is that Disney is still interested in doing something with AI, but they haven't figured out precisely what yet.
Yes, which is true of most of the major studios. Like, you know, I've talked to Josh D'Amaro, the CEO of Disney, about this, and he says generally that AI is important and they, you know, it can enhance creativity and make the processes more efficient, blah, blah, blah. But they haven't figured out what they're going to do. My sense is after, you know, this OpenAI thing was a total black eye for them. Like, it made them look dumb to have made this partnership, make a big announcement out of it, and then have it collapse. So I suspect they're not going to want to do another splashy big announcement partnership like that. And they don't not tie themselves so hard to one company. And they're going to try to do things a little quieter and perhaps work with numerous partners.
Yeah. We're going to come back to OpenAI in a minute because there's another kind of newsy thing happening with them and a movie studio, some controversy, maybe controversy, I don't know, over there. All right. So let's see. Then there's Paramount and Warner Brothers, which I think we can think about in tandem since Paramount Skydance is purchasing Warner Brothers. Looks like that deal is probably going to go through. And of course, the real entity backing this whole thing is Oracle, which is a giant tech platform. But like, it's not clear to me that outside of promises that Paramount is going to, you know, use the Oracle technology to, you know, make the apps better and make their workflow better, and you know, they're going to combine. Yeah. They're going to combine cloud storage to, you know, create redundancies and what. But it's not actually 100% clear to me what they are doing on this side of things, on the kind of like tech AI side of things. It's weirdly kind of a black box right now.
Yes, they've generally talked about trying to use Oracle Cloud tech to drive efficiencies because they need to find ways to save money when they merge these companies, but what will that specifically mean and what role will AI play? They have been vague. So I think it's actually a big question of like, are they going to come in really aggressively and try to use tech to overhaul the process? Or is this kind of all talk to try to convince their investors and their lenders that they know something special the other studios don't? And then in practice, they're just going to be trying to make good movies and hoping that they're hit the box office and they don't have any actually sharper insights and plans than that. The TBD, yeah. You know, and I think the ultimate question, right, will be like, do they build like a modern next generation movie studio, or does David Ellison just want to like, does he just want to like run a studio and because he's the son of a billionaire, he's going to get to do it?
Yeah. Again, it just feels like it like for all of this talk about, you know, tech and everything else, it is the one that feels like there's the least going on. But then you look at Apple Studios is another one where Apple Studios is making lots of things and they're making things that aren't cheap. And, you know, Apple is a company that actually has been kind of, I would not say on the outside looking in of AI, but they have also been a little bit slower to adopt than some of the other tech companies. I feel like I'm reading that basically right.
Yeah. 100%. If anything, you're being generous. I mean, their efforts to make themselves a player on their own terms on AI have gone nowhere, right? Like Siri's fine, but it does not, you know, doesn't remotely compare to like what ChatGPT or Gemini can do. And at this point, it appears clear that Apple is going to end up being a good host platform. You know, their devices will be a great host platform to use various AI, and they'll work with partners on it, but they're not a leader in creating AI models themselves. And to my knowledge, that it speaks to that they haven't like attempted to use AI in any meaningful way in Apple Studios productions at all, which is a notable difference from Amazon, which I assume maybe on your list.
Yeah. Well, let's get to Amazon because this is where the other big kind of story of the last week has come from, which is some background here. Amazon MGM has a longstanding relationship with the filmmaker Luca Guadagnino. He's made films for other people, but he's made, I think, three or four of his last four or five movies for Amazon MGM. He came to them with a script that was about the rise of OpenAI, basically the moment in OpenAI where the board tried to remove Sam Altman. Over the course of a weekend that got reversed and, it's been described a little bit like, The Social Network, but for AI instead of social media. So Amazon MGM has put $40 million into this movie. They've shot it. It's shot. They screened a rough cut of it and then, said, actually, we're not going to distribute this movie. We're not going to distribute it. We're going to try and give it to some. We're going to try and sell it to somebody else. We'll help you. We'll help you find another distributor for it. Blah blah blah. But we're not going to put this movie out. Now, there's some backstory here, which is that Amazon itself, I think, invested $75 or $80 billion or something.
I forget the number, AWS, their Amazon Web Services, has a deal worth tens of billions of dollars with OpenAI. Yes.
Okay. So this is the theory here then is that the relationship with OpenAI for Amazon is too valuable to put out a movie of this sort. So they are trying to offload it. And if they can't, it's going to be a real question of what happens to it. Like what happens to this movie if they cannot find another distributor for it?
That is all correct. I will say, I want to make clear that I do not know for certain why Amazon decided it's not going to release this movie. Obviously, it is true they have this huge deal with OpenAI. The other thing I will just throw in, which is true, is that I have spoken to people at other studios who've screened the movie and with the idea of should we buy this? And I've heard from several people that in their estimation, it's not very good. And they are choosing not to buy it, not because they're worried about any fallout, but because they don't think they make money on it. So this doesn't mean that Amazon is not also taking into account other business considerations, but just keep in mind that at least some people think the movie is not good and doesn't have a lot of commercial potential. But yeah, it obviously is a lot of people in Hollywood scared that, that as big tech, one way or another, takes over the entertainment industry, that these much more economically significant relationships are going to impact creativity and artistic freedom, especially if people want to make creative work that deals with big tech and its impact in our society. And obviously it's one of the most important cultural questions of our time. And one would hope that art can address that stuff in provocative ways. And if it can't, or if it has a tougher time, that will certainly be sad for the American entertainment industry.
Well, I want to drill down on this a little bit because it does feel like the kind of overarching idea here, which is that, look, tech is where all the money is. And traditionally, what happens with movie studios, particularly, since the end of the mogul era, since the brothers Warner and, Mayer and the rest, they got out of the business and these studios started passing from corporation to corporation. What ends up happening is a company with a lot of money that has, an affinity for movies, buys these things and plays with them for a little bit and then sells them to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like we are in a moment where there's so much money in tech right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Apple's a $1 trillion company. They have their own studio. Amazon is an enormous company. They have their own studio. There's talk about, I saw somebody joke that OpenAI could just buy a movie studio with the money in their couch and kill this thing. And so that sort of purchasing power does seem like a thing to worry about if you are worried about this very specific thing, which is actual freedom of artistic movement.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing at, the broader topic that is scary to people in the entertainment industry, is that most companies now are not in entertainment primarily to make money from that entertainment, right? Amazon makes entertainment to keep people subscribed to Amazon Prime, right? Mm. That's the main reason why they do it. Apple, it's to get people subscribing to Apple One and using Apple TV. Disney makes more money from their theme parks now than they do from movies or TV. And you could argue that the greatest benefit of Disney's successful movies is the money that it helped them make from toy sales and from theme park visits and so on. So when people don't consider entertainment to be the most important thing they're doing, then they're willing to compromise that entertainment for other incentives that are more meaningful to them, you know? And that's scary. I mean, just like, yes, what's happening to artificial now, like, is worrisome to people, but it points to there's this bigger issue of like, Amazon could just shut down Amazon's Prime Video tomorrow. Like, they could just get out of the business entirely and their stock probably wouldn't move one penny. Right?
Right.
I mean, that's scary. Frankly. Yeah, it could. Yes. Yeah.
I joke, but I, you know, it's funny. I was going back and reading the portion in your book that's about the founding of Amazon Studios, because it was this. I remember when Amazon Studios started making movies, and they put out a movie by Spike Lee and a movie by Whit Stillman, and they're putting out, you know, they were putting out like very good, kind of independent minded, entertaining, well-made pictures. And it was nice to have that, that sort of a new player in that space. And, you know, you could just go read how Ted Hope has spent the last, you know, 5 or 6 years since leaving Amazon. He's not thrilled, by anything that's happening. But what am I trying to say here? There was this real glimmer of like, hey, this could be a fun, exciting new thing. And now it just feels like it's all getting, everything is just getting ready to be data for the data companies.
Yes. I mean, so what you're pointing to is when Amazon first got into movies, they were acting like they were the new Miramax or something. They were making primarily kind of low to mid budget indie style auteur movies. And as they've grown, I would say they've become more mainstream. I mean, it's not like they're making just a bunch of IP-driven crap, although they did just release the He-Man movie, which arguably was that. But, you know, they made Project Hail Mary, which was based on a book, but like very well-liked, very well-reviewed, extremely successful. They make a wide variety of movies, but they're no longer like aspiring to be the next Miramax. They're aspiring to be the next Warner Brothers or Universal, is where they are. And, there's certainly a lot less energy in the indie festival, politically provocative part of the movie business than there was 10, 20, certainly 30 years ago, like at its peak in the 1990s. Like, that business is a fraction of what it was. And even the indie studios like A24 and Neon really make most of their money now from horror movies.
Right. Right. I mean, just like an Obsession and Backrooms. I mean, it's funny. There was a chart in your piece about the deal with Google that we started this episode talking about, that just looks at the highest grossing A24 films of all time. And this is a thing I already knew, because I am like obsessed with A24 box office. I find it to be a fascinating company, and also like punching way above its weight in terms of cultural cachet versus, actual success. But Backrooms is the highest grossing A24 film of all time by an enormous margin, more so than Marty Supreme, which was its previous number one, and then you go back a little bit, that Civil War a couple years ago, which was a little more expensive, and then but Backrooms cost $10 million and it's grossed almost $300 million, I think.
It's over 300 and it's still going.
Yeah. So like that does, Obsession, of course, is another one that's Focus Features and Universal, Comcast. But, same basic story there. Focus buys that for $13 million and it's, going to end up grossing $400 million worldwide. Some crazy numbers, some just enormous amount of money. And that is always, that's always nice to see. But it definitely it's a limited slice of what film can be. I say that as somebody who loves horror films. I look, I love horror, but you know, it's
right, 100%. That's great. But you, if you love film, you want to see the widest possible variety of movies getting made. And if you want that, then the business models behind them need to work. And I would say right now, the business model of horror works. The business model of tentpole event movies works. It works enough to certainly keep the studios to keep doing it. But the business model for like the Spike Lee movie that you just mentioned, you know, like it's very hard to make money on a Spike Lee movie these days. Yeah. Take an obvious example.
No? Yeah. All right. So let me, ask one real quick question here that may actually end up being a fairly long question. So you wrote The Big Picture. Again, this came out, let's say you wrote it almost 10 years ago, let's say. Let's just for sake. What if you were writing a sequel to that, if you're writing a sequel to The Big Picture, you know, The Fight for the Future of Movies, right? That was the subtitle. We are in the future of movies. It's 10 years later. What does the story of the last 10 years look like?
Looks like things, the broad scope, I would say, is things got very scary and very depressing. And now we're just in a moment where there was a glimmer of hope again. 2020, 2021, you saw simultaneously, right, the shutdown of movie theaters and every major studio launching their own streaming service to try to compete with Netflix. So it really, really got people out of the habit of going to theaters because you couldn't. And then you didn't have to. Studios were putting so much stuff online in order to try and boost the growth of Disney Plus and HBO Max and so on. Remember, they were putting tons of movies that were originally going to be made for theaters onto streaming at that time. So why would people go to theaters? And there was really worry that movie theaters were going to become like going to the Broadway, you know, going to Broadway or the opera or something. And we have been consistently below the box office of the 2010s. And every type of movie, with the exception of horror, has been really challenged. The big franchises have been sputtering. At the time I wrote that book, it seemed like Marvel, Fast and Furious, Transformers, they were just unbeatable. Like every single one grossed like $1 billion, regardless of how good they were, frankly. That stopped working in the 2020s. You start to see Marvel have a bunch of flops. Fast and Furious has lost speed, and no pun intended, and so on. And so there really was this existential crisis of like, people are just not going to go to the movies as much as they used to, right? But the thing that's gotten people excited is that young people will turn out and for certain films, and they actually will turn out for things that feel more authentic and real, made by humans. So like Sinners was, you know, this huge, exciting success story for people in Hollywood. And now this year, seeing Obsession in Backrooms, like those are not franchise movies at all. Those are not hits anybody could predict. And so there is this hope that we are entering an era like the 70s, when the stuff that used to work is not resonating with young audiences. And therefore we will see a lot more experimentation, and we will see a lot more originality, and we will see a lot more auteurs, frankly, making their mark and changing the business. So that's got people excited. And I would say it's the first real optimism I've seen in Hollywood since the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. That does feel about right. It does feel like things have maybe turned a corner. I don't know. Obviously the big story of that period was the rise of streaming and how that changed not just distribution patterns, but also, you know, what was getting made, you know, I think we're still, also ties into all this tech talk, right? Like the streaming boom is one of the big reasons that we're having this conversation about, you know, who is watching what and all the data and everything.
100%. And the streaming bust we're going through now, when the services are all making a lot less content, primarily a lot less television, is, I think, just one more reason why the movies have a little bit more life to them, because you actually can't just sit at home and feel like I have an endless amount of stuff to watch, at least as far as premium content, which was the way you did it in 2021, when nobody could possibly even keep up with every new thing popping up on streaming services.
Yeah. All right. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know. What did we not discuss about technology and Hollywood, or really just anything else that we should have talked about?
Let's see. I would just say that, you know, we haven't really talked about how the, you know, the relationship of, you know, social media and short and social video to Hollywood. And it's this in really interesting tension where on the one hand, like, yes, it is obviously a massive source of competition and distraction and people are getting a lot of their entertainment that way. But now, because frankly, because of Backroom Obsession and Iron Lung, maybe the YouTuber Markiplier, people in Hollywood are really hopeful that it can be like the new comic books. It can be a place where you actually find material and you find talent and you bring them to movies, and that there can be a symbiosis between the two rather than pure competition. Mm-hmm. And we'll see whether or not, you know, this is the beginning of a real meaningful trend, or if this was like a weird blip that it just happened. But that is something that is hopeful for Hollywood, that they're not just going to, that like Gen Z is not just staring at their phones constantly and therefore won't go to the movies, that maybe they'll get off their phone. If you are making stuff in the movies, that's relevant to what they're seeing on their phones.
Well, that's the other part of this. I mean, you mentioned the talent and the IP, for lack of a better word. Yeah. But also the audience, like bringing that audience back to the theaters.
100%. I mean, I see this. I know this is the cliche to be like my kid, but I've had this experience in the past year that's like hard to miss. Like, I have a 14-year-old, and for him, culture is primarily like YouTube and video games. Like, that's mm-hmm. what culture means to him. And when that stuff has migrated to movies, it's meaningful to him. Like, when does he get genuinely excited without me telling him anything about a movie? In the past year, it's been Five Nights at Freddy's, it's been Minecraft, it's been Iron Lung, it's been Backrooms. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, those are things he's gotten independently excited about because it's based on culture that is meaningful to him. And obviously mm-hmm. culture to him is what's on his PC.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that all tracks. That all tracks. Ben, thank you so much for being on today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, Sonny. My pleasure.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys soon.